This week, the European Court of Justice finds that we all should have a right to be forgotten. Well, at least in Europe. The TTIP heads into its fifth round of negotiations between the US and the EU. Minnesota passes mobile handset kill switch legislation, the first in the US to do so. Samuel Gibbs of The Guardian reports on a Gartner study on women in tech. And the FCC forges ahead into a comment period on proposed rules to deal with the issue of so-called net neutrality. Welcome back to 40 A&M in 5, the weekly download of 40 A&M LLC. It's Monday, May 19th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First off this week, who among us would want to have a right to be forgotten? Throughout much of the 20th century, and certainly centuries before, many folks struggled day in and day out simply to be remembered. That was before the internet and its promise of 15 minutes of fame for all, and for some, the digital hangover afterwards. In 2012, the European Commission proposed a right to be forgotten in its first draft of a proposed data protection regulation. Of course, the regulation is on course to be perhaps concluded by year's end, although for some, the right to be forgotten provision had seemingly been losing steam. Then came this past week's European Court of Justice ruling, and surprise, and the decision certainly was a surprise to many, the right to be forgotten is very definitely back. How did this happen? Well, Mario Canseco Gonzalez, a Spanish citizen, was upset because when he Googled himself, as some of us are wont to do, one of the first items that came up was a link to a story that his home had been repossessed some 16 years ago. His debts long ago had been paid. He was furious, saying that it hurt his reputation to have those links be the first things that people see. So, he sued. And after a long period of time, he won. But, like most things legal and online, there's more to it. The European Court of Justice said that a newspaper pursuing journalistic purposes could maintain its online links to coverage of the man's problems, but that Google was merely processing personal data in providing the search links. Such data, the court ruled, should be deleted at the man's request if it was indeed outdated and no longer relevant. According to a story by the Washington Post's Craig Timberg, one in four Americans aged 18 to 29 report being embarrassed or upset by something that appears about them online, from an indiscreet picture or Facebook post that in retrospect seems ill-considered, to articles and comments that they didn't even know existed. Mr. Canseco Gonzalez told The Guardian that he doesn't want Google to have to purge all its records about people, saying that he was fighting for the elimination of data that adversely affects people's honor or dignity. Also, according to The Guardian, the case is expected to be used very quickly as precedent in more than 200 cases pending in Spain's court system, where many plaintiffs are also asking for things to be deleted. There are, of course, many whose stories and experiences could genuinely benefit from the impacts of such a ruling. Take, for instance, Paris Brown, who the BBC reports was for six brief days the UK's first youth police and crime commissioner. Then 17, Brown had posted some comments as a 13 or 14-year-old that could have been construed as homophobic or racist. In tendering her resignation, Ms. Brown said that as a youngster, she had fallen into the trap of behaving with bravado a few times on a social networking site. And despite that she must have shown great poise and intelligence in winning her post as Britain's youth commissioner, the top result on a Google search for her now is a Daily Mail article calling her foul-mouthed and offensive. Indeed, as the BBC reported in commenting on the turn of events for Ms. Brown, the adult police and crime commissioner for Kent, Anne Barnes, noted that, "I'm sure many today would not today have their jobs if their thoughts in their teenage years were scrutinized." It is for this reason, particularly as a reset button for youthful indiscretion, that some see the new ruling as worthwhile. Polly Neat, chief executive of Women's Aid, an anti-domestic violence charity, told the BBC that she welcomes the changes that would give survivors of domestic violence more control over their personal details online, but added, "What would be better would be to ensure that victims aren't named in the first place." Another BBC article by Dave Lee cites the Canada Financial Post's quote of lawyer Jeff White, who believes that some privacy advocates might leverage the decision to recommend that Canada follow a similar path, particularly with minors. And in fact, some U.S. states have already or are poised to act on legislation to create a right to delete for minors. That law, signed by Governor Brown in California in October, applies to websites that have actual knowledge that a particular user of their site is a minor, based upon their profile and online activity. The law in California compels a site to let users delete rants, tweets, status updates, and other material. In a way, this equates to what Stephen Balcom, president of the Family Online Safety Institute, had referred to as the right to be forgiven for children, not to be forgotten. Although Facebook and Twitter are among the few companies to have already offered such an option to their users, the California law requires it across the board for all sites accessible to children living in the state. For these reasons, some are seeing the breadth of this ruling from the European Court of Justice, applying to an across-the-board right to delete for all ages, to be counterproductive, and even smacking of censorship. In The Guardian, journalist James Ball described the ruling as either an eerie parallel with China's domestic censorship of search results, or a huge incentive for tech investment to get the hell out of Europe. And the ruling is, not to put too fine a point on it, scaring the hell out of tech. What it might cost to act on, the expected deluge of requests to delete, and how to scrutinize legitimate from not-so-legitimate requests in complying with this ruling and its hazily broad mandate. The Washington Post reported on a comment from former head of consumer protection for the Federal Trade Commission, David Vladek, who said that if you are a 16-year-old and you do something dumb, there is a way to hit the reset button, he added. But privacy rights shouldn't be a tool to rewrite history. The civil liberties campaign organization Big Brother Watch, which is UK-based, largely agreed, saying in a release on the ruling that if we start to make intermediaries responsible for the actions of the content of other people, you're establishing a model that leads to greater risk of censorship. Minnesota has become the first U.S. state to pass so-called kill switch legislation, permitting mobile users to remotely disable or even wipe clean the data from their stolen handsets. With the law's passage on May 15th, any smartphone sold in the state from July 2015 onward must be fitted with anti-theft software. Reportedly, California is close to introducing a similar piece of legislation. Congress has been vetting some legislation on this subject for some time. A number of smartphones are already equipped with these tools, and some, including Apple's iPhone, can be equipped with a feature that permits your mobile phone to be tracked, potentially letting you and/or the authorities know where it is, if you can get help looking. While the mobile handset industry generally seems to be embracing the idea of installing phones with software kill switches, there is not one single standard as yet. In the U.S., Apple, Samsung, Verizon, T-Mobile, and others have agreed to have all handsets in the U.S. fitted with anti-theft software after July 2015, although it will not be enabled by default. A user must enable it. The fifth round of EU-US negotiations on the Transatlantic Free Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, will take place this coming week in Arlington, Virginia, running from May 19th through the 23rd. The full plate of negotiating issues are planned to be on the agenda, including trade in goods and services, investment, government procurement, intellectual property rights, electronic commerce and telecommunications, and environment and labor issues. EU and US negotiators also plan to host a forum this coming week, which will take place on May 21st from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. It's planned that stakeholder policy presentations will take up the 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. slot, while a chief negotiator's briefing will take place from 3:15 to 4:30 p.m. Any stakeholder participants or merely attendees must have registered with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative by Friday, May 9th. But if you miss that, all is not lost. At the close of the sessions on Friday, May 23rd, the USTR will hold a media briefing. If you miss the stakeholder sessions, and you don't otherwise have a friend or two filling you in on how these sessions have gone, you'll likely get the full scoop shortly after the Friday briefing on this fifth round of negotiations. Samuel Gibbs of The Guardian Online reported this past week on a new report filed by the Gartner research firm. The report cites that the number of key roles filled by women in the tech industry has remained roughly unchanged for about 10 years. The report, which profiles chief information officers and the challenges that they face, shows that the percentage of women taking that role in tech companies has largely been static at 14% since 2004, when, according to Samuel Gibbs, Gartner first started doing gender analysis. According to The Guardian, the situation in the EU is worse than in developing countries or in the US, where the proportion of women in leadership roles does trend higher. Gartner's data showed that women occupied 11.2% of tech leadership roles in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, compared to 18.1% in the U.S. and 13.4% in Latin America and 11.5% in Asia, according to The Guardian. Samuel Gibbs' article noted comments from the Gartner team, one of which from Tina Nuno, a vice president and fellow at Gartner, who noted that a lot of companies thought that when they saw women candidates leaving positions in the tech industry, they believed at first that perhaps it was in order to have families. But the more recent data that they've seen indicates that instead women seem to have grown intolerant of situations where they feel that men who are not as qualified as them have been promoted over them, frequently just leaving the position. Some companies in the U.S., according to The Guardian, are experimenting with reducing job applications to qualifications and experience only, removing personal information such as name, sex, and replacing it with a code in parts of the recruitment process. The Guardian Tech article by Samuel Gibbs is available online and ran on May 14th of this past week. For the next 4 months, the public can weigh in on rules that were proposed by the FCC this past Thursday, rules that could ban internet providers from blocking or slowing down access to websites, but may let them charge content companies for faster and more reliable delivery of their traffic to users. We're talking, of course, about the so-called net neutrality rules, or open internet rules, expected to have been discussed this past week at the FCC's open meeting. And they were. The FCC's two Democratic commissioners, although with some expressed misgivings, joined the chairman, Tom Wheeler, in advancing the rules, with the two Republican commissioners voting against moving the rules forward. According to Reuters' Alina Selyuk, the vote was cautiously welcomed by both broadband providers and consumer interest and technology groups, as both sides hope that the ultimate rules, after the comment period, lean their way. The rules could be modified in the course of what the Commission sees from its comment period, but formal adoption is expected this fall. Every now and again, I find a story about something that, although not particularly tech or even particularly related to global policy issues, catches my attention. Such was the case this past week with a story that ran in Viral Nova, which catalogs trending stories on the web. The story is of two anonymous students at the Columbus College of Art and Design who, once a week, sneak into a classroom and leave a masterpiece of their own creation, but one that is entirely made of chalk. The pair remain anonymous, but go by the handle Danger Dust and are known to at least be seniors in advertising and graphic design, very talented ones at that. Some of their creations can be seen online at Viral Nova, and for the artworks that are created on the fly each week, these are astonishing. And that is all we have for you this week. You have been listening to 40A&M in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from Reuters, The Washington Post, The Guardian, the BBC, and Viral Nova. Thank you for listening. 40A&M in 5 will be back with you again, not on Monday, but on Tuesday, May 27th, next week, in view of the Memorial Day holiday in the U.S. Until then, make this week, and every week, one to remember. And bye for now.